God. One garden. One choice. One fall. One abomination. One flesh. One flood. One last chance. Far below our weary feet and high above our interstellar skies, just out of reach of our three-dimensional world, lie truths hidden so deep, woven so intricately into the fabric of the universe, we have no way of ever knowing their path of revelation. They lie dormant in the dark matter of primordial history, locked away deep within the earth, forced to haunt from higher dimensions, prowling the vast universe, clawing their way into our deepest fears, watching, waiting, three, two, one. Paranormal activity, UFOs and UAPs, cryptids, poltergeist, antichrist, fallen angels, giants, portholes, the beast arising from the sea. Who can stand up to him? I ask you, who is like the beast? One God, one war, one victor. This is the story of our past, this is the story of our present, and this is the story of our future. This is Drilling Down.
Welcome everyone to Drilling Down. My name is Kyle Gray, your host as always, and I'm sorry that it took me a good week to put this one out, but you know, when you're talking about the Israeli-Gaza slash Israeli-Iran slash Israeli, you know, you can put any, Libya, it doesn't matter. This is such a big topic. There's almost no way around not having a long episode and not having one that, you know, is at least trying to cover anyone who comes here. As I know, as you look at the title of this episode, I'm going to have thousands of listeners come to this at some point here soon that don't know me at all or what I do at Drilling Down or any of that. So I tried to factor that into this portion as well. I welcome all of you. Thank you for being here. Yes, there is incredibly important news to talk about, and I'll kind of explain as I go forward, you know, all the different aspects and a lot of the complexities around what's happening with Israel. But I'm Kyle Gray, and this is Drilling Down. So those of you that don't know, I will talk about biblical prophecy in this, and I will absolutely try to shed some light on why we are where we are and possibly what to look forward to in the future. Yeah, I know. Fun, uplifting episode, right? I've been pointing people back to my episode 109 and 110. So if you have not listened to those, that is a great start. Those two will talk about the wars that are actually going on right now. Now, whether this is the final war or which leading to the final war, either way, I will unveil through this this particular episode that the stage is, I mean, it is just set. There is nothing more that needs to happen in order for, I believe, Jesus Christ to return. So as we're talking about this, I want to just say, you know, thank you for being here. Keep an open mind. There are some things that I will throw out there that are just my own personal opinion, and other times that I use the Bible and, you know, directly, I will make sure that you understand that as well. So it's my hope and it's my prayer that you guys can get some really good insight and answers into this one. And, you know, one thing I've always said, if you've been with me for quite some time, is you can't ever read the Bible back into the news stories. You have to take the Bible first and then watch the news and see if anything fits in. Okay. That is Bible Prophecy 101. All right. So let's get into this. I'm going to start in a very unusual place, but I have a feeling I know a lot of this is going to be off the cuff, but I know where I want to go with this thing. By the way, those of you who don't know me, I was a full-time pastor for almost 25 years. I have a theology degree. I am no longer in the ministry, and I'm actually recording this after a day of seeing some inspectors here in Indianapolis as I'm traveling for work in the insurance industry. But that being said, I have this channel because I can't take the preaching out of the preacher, right? Take the preacher out of the pulpit, but you can't take the preaching out of the preacher. That's not a saying. I think I just made that up. If I didn't, correct me, but yeah, so I love to do this stuff. I love to still talk about all of this and study all of this. I'm not a scholar you know, I am in my own mind, but for me, I just read the Bible a lot. I've read through the Bible now 78 times in my life and continuing about 12 times a year to read through the Bible again. So for me, it's it doesn't get numbing. No, it doesn't get completely tedious. I do it every month and a half for almost 9 years now. It is unbelievable what is revealed. The inscrutable glories of the deep can simply not be described to those hooked on the safety of the shallowness. Thank you, Calvin Miller. All right, let's get into this. You know, the book of Esther, a lot of times gets an eye roll. At least Ruth in the Bible has this fun kind of Titanic story, right? But Esther, people are just, you know, even some Christians have even argued, or, you know, some scholars have said, why is this even in here, right? Well, as much as I read through the Bible, it's one of my favorite books. I've preached on Ruth a few times in my past. I think I have one of those back in my catalog here. You can go back, listen to that story of Ruth as we do the Through the Bible series. But I never really preached on Esther. And for some reason, it just didn't stick out to me until the past couple of years. Although I knew it, I read it, obviously. It's more important than you could ever imagine. And I'm not going to, well, I am going to start talking about the book of Esther. It's a very short book, but I'm not going to like detail and go through it. Good grief. This episode is going to be long enough on its own without help from me doing it through the Bible in Esther. But I'll give you just a quick rundown. We have the Old Testament, which is the story of God's people, right? From beginning to end, it's the story of the Israelites. And When the book starts, long story short, the Israelite people were started by Abraham, okay, progenitor of the Christian faith. And on from there, his kids, and it's a story of his kids assembling the country of Israel, all the while battling, fighting nations around them. And it's a quest for the nation of Israel. Then they become a nation. And then we go through this wonderful time where they have, you know, King Saul. We'll talk a little bit about that. King David, King Solomon. And then from there, civil war happens between Solomon's kids and the nation of Israel splits into Israel and to Judah. And then the rest of the Old Testament is slowly watching the nation of Israel completely fall apart into oblivion. I know, exciting, fun. The idea that I'm trying to cover here in this episode is giving you a little bit of a story on what Israel and why Israel had to battle. Mixing that in, because nothing's changed on the chessboard, guys. As you read your news and you're tuning into this because you want to hear me talk about, you know, the West Bank, you want to hear me talk about Hamas and Hezbollah and all that stuff, I will. I'm definitely getting into that. But this is a very ancient chessboard and all the players are still there. I just can't believe some people can't stand history. Oh, what we can learn from the failures and successes of our past. I mean, I do that in my own life. I know I have some very good friends that just don't ever look back. Why would I do that? I'm plowing forward. And I can't get behind that. I have to, not that I wallow in it, not that I, you know, but there are days when I just feel like, holy cow, I really screwed this up 10 years ago. Holy cow, I was really an asshat 10 years ago. Holy cow. You know, and you do these things and I failed at this. And, you know, I do those things so that I can, number one, realize that I am quite fallible and quite human and quite fragile. But at the same time, God is more forgiving and more patient and more faithful than I could have ever imagined. There was a time, you know, when Israel didn't have a body of land, and this was obviously from the time of the end of the Old Testament until 1948 as well. But the book of Esther comes at a time when Satan had a very strategic play on the children of Israel. And what's, I think, going to fascinate you the most is the light that it'll be shed on Esther and the people around her, and what it showcases from the Old Testament to what you're turning on your news today. So I'll just kind of do a 30,000 foot view here. There was a king, the king of Persia, in the book of Esther in the Old Testament of the Bible. And long story short, he wants some new ladies. And a woman by the name of Esther goes through the process of getting beautiful, getting all her makeup put on, waiting the months to be good enough, clean enough to be presented in front of the king. And God is working through her. It's very similar to the book of Ruth. Very, very similar. A lot of different parallels that I won't draw to. But there's another friend, ally. I'm really going to go vague here, you guys, so I don't spend my whole time on this. Of Esther, named Mordecai. Mordecai and Esther were very close, and she gets the queen's gig. That's how beautiful she was. That's how, I keep thinking of Miss Congeniality, when somebody is just made to do something. Did I really just bring Miss Congeniality into a podcast episode with Sandra Bullock already when I'm talking about Esther? But, it's just this whole, wow. You know, that the movie trope where they, I'm not saying Esther wasn't hot, but she was, but they kind of did her all up and everything. What does it? Okay. Yeah. So, Esther is taken to the king, and she's secretly, talking about, with Mordecai. No one knew that her and Mordecai knew each other. He's still a peasant in the village, and she is now a queen, but, she keeps talking, and they're gathering intel, and Mordecai would kind of hang out at the king's gate, and he would get some intel for her. And, some of these things were, hey, I'm hearing that, this group over here is going to do this. And so this is very valuable. She could now take this to the king. I don't know. It's like a Princess Bride episode right here in the Bible. And she could tell the king, Princess Buttercup could tell the king. And, without her ever knowing, or the king ever knowing, that she knew Mordecai and so forth. So this was great. And so Mordecai does this, and I'll read here. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred to her people. Okay. She didn't tell anyone in Persia where she comes from, who her people were. Who were they, Kyle? You should know that, number one. But number two, hang on. As Mordecai had commanded her, he didn't want her to tell anyone, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. This is great. Great father figure. In those days, Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. Bigan and Teresh and the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold became angry and sought to lay hands on king. Okay, so these guys, we're going to uncover a plot right now of the king with an assassination plot against him. So he goes and he tells Esther, and Esther tells the king, and they investigated it, and they found it to be so. And so those men were hung by the gallows in the castle courtyard. Oh, pretty cool, huh? Recorded in the book of Chronicles. And so there's this really bad dude named Haman, H-A-M-A-N. Boy, just one letter off from being He-Man. Actually, there is a man named He-Man in the life of Solomon. Did you know that? Maybe you shouldn't know that, but I know that. Yep, freaking He-Man. They have probably called him Haman or Haman. But He-Man's way cooler. Anyway, He-Man has a plot against the Jews. This jerk face, he comes in, and he's been promoted. His name is Haman, that the Bible says the Agagite. Okay, remember this. Haman is an Agagite. Okay, it's important who you are in this plot, because it's important in biblical history, and it's very important in the Old Testament. All right. So this evil man named Haman gets promoted by the king, and the king's servants and everyone are hanging down at the gate, And Mordecai, this man Haman, hates Mordecai. He's filled with fury because Mordecai, you know, anybody that's evil always hates somebody that's righteous and somebody that's honest and somebody that's true. And Haman, you know, he probably knew that Mordecai had, Haman wants the throne, right? Haman wants, he wants power. He wants glory. He wants influence. He wants it all. And here's freaking Mordecai, who goes to church every day. Black and white dude, playing by the law, Debbie Downer, keeps thwarting his plans. So Haman says, hey, king of Persia, who you don't really freaking care who the Jews are, because he knew Mordecai was a Jew. Nobody knew Esther was. Whoops, just gave that one away. Yeah. Mordecai goes to the king and says, hey, you know, there's these people that are scattered all around and they're in the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from every other people and they don't keep the king's laws. This is right in the Bible. So that it's not the king's profit to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, evil Haman says, Haman the Agagite, it will be decreed and they will be destroyed. Okay, so he's saying there's this people group and Haman doesn't know, or I'm sorry, the king doesn't know about the Jews or like anything else that's going on. He just knows in his kingdom, he's got this ragtag bunch of people who are worshiping this weird god named Yahweh. They didn't really have a city or anything for themselves. And Haman's looking to kill all of them. I mean, all of them. And mostly including Mordecai. So let me advance this a little bit. Esther finds out about this and she's just beside herself. She knows that if she were to reveal she was a Jew as the queen, she would technically have to die as well. She didn't care about that, though. That's how honoring and just a good lady she is. She doesn't want all the Jews to be killed. And God uses her and God uses Mordecai. And so Mordecai starts finding out things about Haman, the Agagite. And I'm going to say it again, long story short, he finds out that Haman has got a plan to kill Mordecai and to hang him and to kill all the Jews. And so he tells Esther about it. And I will tell you the little story here. I'll read from the book of Esther. Haman plans to hang Mordecai. Kyle, where are you going with this? And Haman went out that day, joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, he neither rose. Mordecai was like giving the middle finger, nor rose, nor trembled before him. He was filled with wrath against Mordecai. This is like a Princess Bride episode. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted them the splendor of riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions within the king have honored him, and how he had advanced. What the? Whoa. Why is my alarm going off? I'm going to keep it in there. Who cares? I'm going to keep rolling. And all the promotions the king had honored him and how he had advanced him above all the officials and the servants of the king. And then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come to the king to the feast that she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her, Esther's working behind the scenes here, together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew. Look at this little man sitting at the king's gate. And then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully to the king and to the feast. And this idea pleased Haman. I bet it did. And he had the gallows made. So this guy gets these 50 giant gallows made, of which he's going to create this spectacle. This is a big deal. And he's going to hang Mordecai on it. And then he's going to go to a feast with the king and Esther, or the other way around. I mean, this is going to be a day for him. Everything he has ever evilly planned is coming to fruition. And so the king finds out through, you know, God's work, but some people that found out within his court that Mordecai had really been uncovering some serious plots. And that this Mordecai dude, who's just a peasant, I mean, he was better than that, but he's just down there in the mix of the people. And he's helped the king more than once. And the king says, who is this guy? Bring him up here. I want to meet him. And so the riff becomes even worse, as you can imagine, between Haman and Mordecai, because Haman sees the king now looking at Mordecai, his archenemy, in good light. And Esther reveals or gets the idea revealed to her, long story short, that Haman, I am not doing a good job explaining this, say Haman, it's because I just decided to do this when I heard my intro music. It popped into my head. I said, I should probably go to Esther on this one. Oh, it's no prep at all here. Okay. So anyway, long story short, the king and Haman go into feast with Queen Esther. I'm going to read this. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine, wow, these guys just go hard in the paint for days in the Bible and at their parties. And the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, what is your wish, Queen Esther? Oh, this is great. It's her, Mordecai, the king, man, Mordecai's riding high, baby. It should be granted to you, whatever it is. And what's your request? Even to half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. Wow, she must have been hot. Ladies, I'm not suggesting you have to be hot to have power, okay? I'm just saying, I bet she was hot. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for just one wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I, listen, and my people, and you can hear the king and all of his court going, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And if we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. And the king turns and says to Esther, who is this man? Who is he? Who has dared to do this? He's pissed off. And Esther said, a foe and the enemy. It's him. And she points to Haman, wicked Haman. And Haman absolutely crapped his pants and pissed his tunic. The Bible says he was terrified before the king and the queen. And as the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden, he was pacing back and forth, ready to absolute. Should I draw and quarter this guy? Should I burn him at the stake? What should I do? But Haman stayed there begging for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine. And as Haman, this evil man who was plotting to destroy every Jew, including Mordecai, had no idea it was Esther as well, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was, and the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? Guys, this is in the Bible. How freaking awesome is the Bible? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. Ah, and the wrath of the king abided. Now, Kyle, why are you telling me this? Because Esther chapter 8 gives kind of this summary of everything, as bad as I just did going through this. And the title of it in the Bible is Esther Saves the Jews. And Mordecai comes. This is truly like the ending of the first Star Wars. Mordecai comes and, you know, everybody's honored. And there's this whole. And they get honored. Everybody kind of falls at their feet and thanks them for this evil plot. The king's scribes are summoned at that time, and, you know, everybody is given great wealth. Mordecai is given fame. Everything ends really well. And it gets even better because chapter 9, the Jews destroy their enemies. So out of this plot to exterminate the Jews comes the Jews actually gathering, Mordecai leading them, and they struck their enemies with the sword. And the Bible says in Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. So they're going to battle even in the city of the castle. and the king is pleased. And the Jews come into the king's provinces and his presence, and they get relief from their enemies. And the Bible says the Feast of Purim is inaugurated. So I want you to remember that. Out of all this comes the Jews almost to the edge of extinction, which turned into them having relief and being delivered from their enemies, from Haman the Agagite in Persia, and the Feast of Purim, and basically, or Purim, I should say, if you want me to say it properly, not English, is that it gets another feast, an Israelite feast, which we'll talk about later, gets implemented. That's a big deal. Book of Esther closes out with how blessed Mordecai was after that. Okay. So thank you for bearing with me through the book of Ruth, the book of Esther there. Really, truly, I can't wait to break that one down in a Through the Bible series, because I'm going to do a little bit of that later here, but nowhere near what I'll do in that series. So I'm telling you guys, there's not one portion of the Bible you can't read. And if you're reading it properly, and if you are, you're aware of some of the surroundings and the nations at the time, how much of the Bible is opened up to you. That's how you can read it 12 times a year from front to back and never get bored and even learn new things daily, every single read. Unbelievable. Okay. So one thing I waffled with a little bit when it came to this particular episode was, how much background do I do on where Israel came from? You know, basically the modern day Israel. How much background do I do on how they got their shape, and, you know, obviously through World War II and all that kind of stuff. So that was a little bit of a struggle for me, because I don't want to get weighed down too much, because in the end, you can do your own research on that. That's very easy. Same with, you know, I will cover modern, you know, some of the modern stuff that's going on in the last 2 weeks, really detailing Israel and Hamas. But what I want to do is I want to help you understand the root of what's going on, so that, you know, my goal isn't that you come here and you hear me tell you what the news is telling you. And you're like, man, Kyle's so into the news. My goal is that I show you some very important things from the Bible and how I look at the world and how I look at the news. And then when you go turn on the news later after watching this, or the next day or whatever, you're really going to understand some things better. That's my goal. That's why I'm here. That's why you guys don't pay me. That's why I don't ask for money. And that's why I don't have, any sponsors to the show. Pretty awesome. This is a money losing endeavor, but I'm getting the word out there, and it's worth it all to me. The area known as Palestine, or what we're going to call Gaza. This is an audio podcast. I don't do YouTube. So, yeah, picture Israel, right? I guess let's take a peanut, right? The shape of a peanut, sort of, and it's vertical, not a horizontal peanut laying on a table. Take a peanut and put it up. Horrible, like the planners do, little bow tie. Does he have a monocle? It's the Mandela effect that the Monopoly guy had a monocle, because he never did. I think Mr. Peanut did at one point. Anyway, here's this peanut vertical. That's the nation of Israel. Okay. So over on the left side of the peanut, I can't believe I'm talking about peanuts, is Gaza. Just this tiny little sliver. It's like, you know, Israel's the size of New Jersey anyway. So we're talking very, very tiny. All right. It's surrounded by these massive evil nations. And I say evil because they exist to destroy Israel, and they have from the beginning of time. All right. I'm not saying the people in these, I'm not that guy that's saying all the people in these Muslim countries are evil. That's not true, but the governments are. I can tell you Israelite's government is quite evil as well. So don't get me mixed up on that. The current Israelite government has done horrible things with the sex trade. They're not godly people. You have to remember that. They're not godly people. So I'm not on this podcast. I'm sorry, saying Israelite's perfect. And everyone else around them just wants to kill them. That is not me. I'm not a Zionist in that speaking, but they are God's chosen people and they do have a huge part in our past and definitely our future from here on out. So they are up against a lot surrounding them. Now, we have on the peanut, we have Israel, which is the majority of the peanut. I'm just doing this off the cuff of my head, picturing a peanut now, right, Mr. Planner? Up at the top, we have Syria. At the bottom, we have Egypt. And then we're going to have we're going to have what's called the West Bank. And that's on the whole kind of right coast of Israel. And that's going to kind of bleed over into Jordan. That's going to bleed over into some Muslim states. But that's where Jerusalem is. And that's where all the contention with Muslim things are happening in the West Bank there. Then on the left coast, you have a little sliver called Gaza, and it's land trapped. There's only a little corridor at the bottom that shares a border with Egypt. We'll talk about that a little bit later. There's the ocean, and then there's Israel. It is truly an air prison. That's what it's been called for years, and that's what it is. These people have revolted many times. But what I want to help you out with here is that these people are ancient people. And they have an ancient story along with the Israelites, literally. So that's what I'm going to get into, because I really think it will help. Looking back, and I'll just go back a couple hundred years, the British take control of the area known as Palestine. They defeat the Ottoman Empire, who had,
the Arabian Nights, like Arabian Days.
You have all that Ottoman Empire stuff that's happened throughout history while the Dark Ages are happening. That, Chinese are coming up, the Mongols, right? So it's funny, you have Genghis Khan, because it's, again, people forget things are happening all over the world while Israelites become a nation. So the Ottoman were ruling. It was that whole Mideast type of thing. And so the Ottoman are ruling that part of the Middle East during World War I. And the land was inhabited by just a few Jews at the time, but majority were Arab and smaller ethnic groups. It was kind of like a petri dish of just small Bedouin, tribes during World War I. And so tensions amongst primarily the Jewish and the Arab community start boiling over when the United Nations is coming out of, World War I, defeats the Ottomans, and they kind of have the UK, I should say, has the task of establishing a national home for Jewish people in Palestine. You talk about a thankless job, after World War I. Here, hey, we got all these Jews. I want you to, you want us to like stuff them in part of France where they're safe? Nah, we're going to put them kind of where they originally came from. We're going to stuff them back into Palestine. Shouldn't be a problem. Everybody should eventually get along, because they always have so well. This stemmed from the Balfour Declaration, 1917. It was a pledge made by Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour to British's Jewish community. The declaration was enshrined in the British Mandate over Palestine and endorsed by the newly created League of Nations, a forerunner to the United Nations in 1922. To Jews, Palestine was their ancestral home, but Palestine Arabs also claimed the land and opposed the move. Could you imagine your mom and dad sending you to live in the most hostile environment you could possibly imagine, with your family history, with your ethnicity, with your religion, with hostile intentions? That's what happened. Now, Jordan occupied some land that became known as the West Bank that I told you about, and Egypt occupied some of Gaza. Jerusalem itself, which we see as the capital, was divided between, thanks to Donald Trump. Don't get me started on what a horrible man Donald Trump is, but I respect some of those things he did in regards to Israel. Jerusalem was divided between Israeli forces in the west and Jordanian forces in the east. So even that part, even the West Bank part of Israel and Jerusalem, is divided, because there was never a peace agreement and there were wars upon wars and fighting for many decades. So that's what you have in Jerusalem. You have this one part where the Jews can go, And then you have the you have obviously the whole Muslim side of Jerusalem. So it is just an absolute powder keg because it's holy to all of them. And then the Catholic Church gets in there. So it's holy to them there too. It is a volcano waiting to explode. That's just Jerusalem. Now, Gaza, over on the left of the peanut, that's a narrow strip of land sandwiched between Israel and the Mediterranean Sea, with super short southern border in Egypt, like I said. It's tiny, and it has more than 2 million people, and it's one of the most densely populated places on Earth. You know, you always see these sci-fi movies, right, where, I don't know, maybe it's a futuristic city, but it's small, and everybody's absolutely crammed in all these high-rises. Well, it's like kind of like a lot of China, to be honest with you. I have not been to China, but my friends that have all come back and said, holy cow, they are stacking people upon stacking people. So anyway, that is very much what Palestine, Gaza is like. And they are landlocked. They cannot go in or out without Israel's permission. And this is the part of the podcast that I debated how long do I go on this particular side of things? And I decided to be not too long because, you know, I don't know if you like Wikipedia or not. I do. And they have some great things on all of this conflict that you can read into. It absolutely gets messy. So what I'll just do is I'll say in the wake of 1948 and 1949, when Israel's becoming a nation, Gaza had been occupied by Egypt for 19 years. And so Israel rolls in and occupies Gaza in the 1967 war, and they stayed till 2005. Israel runs it. They were building Jewish settlements there, but then they withdrew their troops and settlers in 2005. Though it retained control over the airspace of Gaza, Palestine, and it made or retained control over the shared border and the navy, the shoreline. So the UN, I'm reading here in an article I just pulled up, still considers the territory to be occupied by Israel, although it's not. It's now fully run by a terrorist organization that we'll talk about later called Hamas. I want to read just a little bit here on, and then I'm going to get into some Bible prophecy that's going to be really fun and correlate that to the modern day news cycle that you came here for. I'm going to read a little blurb here. The Gaza-Israeli conflict is a localized part of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The conflict originated with the election of the Islamist party Hamas in 2005 and 2006 in the Gaza Strip and escalated with the split of the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian government into the Fatah government in the West Bank and the Hamas government in Gaza and the following violent ousting of Fatah after Fatah lost the election to Hamas. So there's this big fighting to see who's going to be the evil takeovers there. Palestinian rocket attacks on Israel, Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, and the joint Egyptian-Israeli blockade of Gaza have exacerbated the conflict. The international community considers attacks on civilians and civilian structures that do not discriminate between civilians and military targets illegal under international law. There's so many complexities. As part of its 2005 disengagement plan, Israel retained exclusive control over Gaza's airspace and territorial waters, and it continued to patrol and monitor the external land perimeter of the Gaza Strip. With the exception of its southernmost border, where Egypt retained control of the border, these poor people, and border crossings were supervised by European monitors, and continued to monitor and blockade Gaza's coastline, Israel largely provides and controls Gaza's water supply, their electricity, and communications infrastructure. These people are at the mercy of Israel, and Israel has not always been kind to them. According to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, Israel remains an occupying power under international law. The United Nations has stated that under resolutions of both the Grand Assembly and the Security Council, it regards Gaza to be part of the occupied Palestinian territories. Meanwhile, the Fatah government in the West Bank, internationally recognized as the sole representative of the state of Palestine, refers to the Gaza Strip as part of the Palestinian state and does not recognize the Hamas government. I'm almost done here. Human Rights Watch have described the Gaza Strip, which has been under Israel blockade since 2007. They describe it as a, quote, open air prison, unquote. Last sentence here. The conflict is also a scene of power struggle between regional powers, including Egypt, Iran, Turkey, and Qatar, supporting different sides of the conflict in light of the regional standoff between Iran and Saudi Arabia, on one hand between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and on the other, as well as a crisis in the Egyptian-Turkish relations. If you ever spent any amount of time, maybe YouTubing Israel-Muslim conflict for dummies, explain like I am five, you know, how whatever you want to search for, you're going to, you know, you can't. I can't tell you how many podcasts I've listened to in the past and seen YouTube videos and all this trying to explain the intricacies of everything that's happening in the Middle East. There's no place like it in the world. It's always been like that, and it always has been. And so when you look at it, you go, well, why is that? Like, we're not doing that with Canada. You know, we might be fighting the cartels and all of this, you know, our border stuff that's happening right now. But like, you know, this isn't happening here. It doesn't happen in Europe. It doesn't happen in Africa. Well, I mean, technically it does. Know your continents, guys. You know what I'm saying? You get what I'm saying? What in the world? And why can't they? And why is it always them? It's like their world is so different, you guys, than anything that we have. You know, you go to Finland, you go to Iceland, you go to Germany, you go to Poland, right? You go to Switzerland. You know, you've got like it's everything's built up. It's beautiful. It's modern. You've got railway systems. You know, look what China looks like. Look what Japan looks like. Let's just keep going on. Australia. Let's look at Melbourne looks like. Look at the United States. Let's look at Vancouver, Toronto. You know, let's look at Mexico City. But we're going all around here. We're looking at Brazil. Okay. And, you know, some of these nations are more third world nations and they're going to have like these struggles and they're going to have mafia problems and they're certainly going to have cartel problems or things like that. But the look of them are like real buildings and everything. And everything around the Middle East is like, it looks like a movie set of just grim. And I'm not talking about Dubai. Okay, obviously, there's a different thing happening with Saudi Arabia. I might talk about that later too. But just the cold, like even Russia has a look. And that still gets a little bit, you know, like North Korea, it gets a little bit like, whoa, something's just off. Like the architecture and you kind of faked through some of this stuff, right? These buildings are really empty over here. You know, there is some of that, but there is a look to it. The Middle East looks the same. And much of Israel looks the same. And it's because they have always been fighting. Have you ever run into that family where no one gets along and no one, I mean, there are no family reunions. No one is ever getting together. The brothers hate each other. The sisters hate each other. The parents and the aunts and uncles. I know a few families like that. And it's like, you know, they've been going on like this for hundreds of years. And they are never, ever going to get along. Well, imagine a family that's been happening with for upwards of, well, let's just say 10,000 years as nations. And it will never change. And it will always be a struggle for them, for all of them. And it will never lead to prosperity amongst them. What are the main problems between Israelis and Palestinians? I'm going to say I'll put four of them down here. Okay. The two sides cannot agree on these are the, I'm really going to boil it down. And then we're going to go into some Bible prophecy. Here's what the Palestinians and the Israelites cannot agree on. Number one, what should happen to Palestinian refugees? Number two, whether Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank should stay or should they be removed and completely handed over to the Muslims. Number three, whether the two sides should share Jerusalem. They don't like to share, neither of them. And four, the most tricky of all, whether a Palestinian state should be created alongside Israel. Those are four things. And those are the four things that almost can be, you know, every conflict, every problem they are having, as far as the external news cycle things, can be dumped into those funnels. What do we do with all these refugees? Should Israelites even be in Jerusalem at all? Well, that's why it was such a big deal when Donald Trump named Jerusalem. You see, whether the two sides should even share Jerusalem. And if Israel gets to have their own state, then let's make the Gaza Strip in Palestine its own Muslim nation. And nobody can agree on any of it. Okay. Now, I don't want to get political here right now, but, you know, one of the things that Donald Trump did was he was extremely pro-Israel. Now, I'm not convinced at all that he did it out of the goodness of his heart or even from a love of the Bible. Too many things he has done in his life where he just becomes all things to all people, whatever gets him the power. But that being said, he was very tough on Iran, Russia, China, and pro-Israel. So, you know, that part of it I loved. But President Obama for 8 years before him was not so kind to Israel, not so pro-Israel. And Joe Biden, in the few years here before, you know, I posted this episode, in a way gave $6 million back to Iran. What a bad, bad thing it is to do. To give a nation like that the ability to do whatever they want. I don't want to get political, but Iran has been emboldened. Iran has been propped up by Russia and by proxy, China. If you go back and listen to my episode 109 to episode 110, I will not go through all that right now, but I just will tell you that I believe this thing that is happening right now is a war that Israel ultimately will have, whether it comes today, tomorrow, in 2 years, or in 10 years, or in 1,000 years. I think we all know the shorter time frame is probably the more realistic. The fact that the surrounding nations, including Hamas, Hezbollah to the north, Syria, we see Jordan, even parts of Egypt, that come against the Israelites, according to the Bible. This is all in the Bible. And I go through it painstakingly in episodes 109 and 110. And so Israel will win that war as it's happening, and they will have freedom. I believe they will have, you know, all these borders, all these gates, all these tunnels, all these fences, all these guard shacks, all this barbed wire, all of the military surrounding it. They're going to have relief from that because they're going to win a huge war coming up. And fast forward, the next thing that happens is as they are, quote unquote, asleep at the wheel, this is where the Antichrist rises up. This is where a coalition with Russia, China, Iran, Turkey even comes in, and according to the Bible, and is so close to annihilating Israel. They have no chance, which it means the United States is not on Israel's side by then. So I project this to be you know, at least 10 years in the future where, you know, either there's a pre-trib rapture. I don't care if you believe in a pre-trib rapture or a post-trib rapture. What, I don't care. I don't care. But a pre-trib rapture sure would explain where we go. But we might just meld into the European Union here eventually. And we just don't have a say. Like I say in episode 109 or 110, the young lions of Tarshish in the Bible. I believe that's us. All right. I don't want to go back into all of that now, but as students of Bible prophecy, which is what we all are, that's why we're here, right? We should pay attention. Because the Bible tells us in the end times, Israel is going to be scattered and then they are going to be regathered. Now, this has happened from the book of Esther that we read to the fact that we're here now, you know, Israel bringing coming back into their own nation from 1948, a couple episodes ago, I talked about the U.S.'s role in all this and what it's been. So go back and listen to that. And so here we are. The prophetic clock is ticking. You know, you had the Holocaust, World War II. There's a lot of debate. There's, I mean, plenty of YouTubers. There's plenty of podcasters out there who have the take that the Holocaust never really happened, and they have all their proof and all these things. Now, I think that's insane. What I don't know is we don't know how many people exactly were killed. The Jews have certain, and you know, people will cite the, how much the Jews have benefited from the museums all over of the Holocaust financially, to their positions of power and all these kind of things. You know, and the question comes up, were they inflating the numbers? I don't care because it happened. And on the heels of the Holocaust, who would have ever thought that these Jewish people who lost 6 million lives estimated to the Nazis could ever regather in their homeland? But it happened against all odds. May 14th, 1948, as you know, Israel became a nation. And I'm proud to say the United States was the first nation to acknowledge it. And I love that. But Israel was regathered. And the Lord said from the Bible, when this happens, they are going to be attacked. And that is my episode 109 and 110. Now, I always point people back to my episode 69, nice, which is an entire episode exactly on how Israel got to this point and how they became a nation and all the miraculous things that would have to come into place in order for them to become a nation. So go back and listen to that if you have not. But against all odds, here they do. But God says when they do become a nation, again, one day when I do bring them back, when I regather them from the diaspora, there's going to be some wars. And in episode 109 and 110, I talk about Ezekiel 38, 37, where the Bible talks about those wars. You go listen to those, okay? There's a lot of people watching modern day Russia right now. If you get out a map of the Middle East, just pretend, you've all seen it, and you look to the north of Israel, what are you going to find? Because they're going to be attacked greatly in the second war from the north. What are you going to find? You're going to find Russia. Will Russia ever want to invade Israel? Yeah, that is definitely, as they are an ally with Persia. The North and Persia are going to attack one day. And that is, of course, Russia. And who's Persia now? Iran. So the Bible predicted hundreds of years ago that this large force from the north of Israel would attack her after she was regathered. And one of the allies that would attack Israel with Russia or Magog or whoever it is would be Iran, then called Persia. Not once in the past 2,500 years, guys, has Russia formed a military alliance with Persia. Not once with Iran. But they have recently developed a special connection. Russia has aligned billion-dollar deals to sell missiles to Iran, and the Iranians have helped the Russians, providing them with drones, weaponized drones, to use in the Ukrainian war. They are becoming fast friends. That has never happened. So as you know, when you turned on the news a few weeks ago, you saw the thousands of rockets rain down on Israel from everywhere. You saw the Iron Dome not being able to keep up. It just looked like fireworks in the sky. Hamas gunmen invaded by land, sea, and sky. This was well planned out. This was well thought out. You all saw the parachutes, Red Dawn style, coming into the festival. They were coming by sea. They were coming by tunnel. They were coming by any way humanly possible. And they initially, in those opening days, grabbed hundreds of people, and they murdered them, and they kidnapped them. And I think they've been watching a lot of ISIS videos over the last 5 to 6, 7 years. You know, I'll talk about this later, but they specifically targeted young women and young children. They launched massive, indiscriminate rocket fire towards civilian population centers, as well as terrorist infiltration of cities and settlements close to the Gaza border. Guys, they went home to home, Hamas did, door to door, looking for the young and the elderly. Some of the women I've seen on the news, they took as hostages, were even survivors of the Holocaust. These frail, poor old women. Now, Kyle, is there propaganda that's out there, even on Israel's side? 100%, absolutely. Guys, CNN and Fox News are absolute horse shit. Yeah. So is every other news outlet. They are feeding you garbage. By the way, a great app that I use, I pay for, is called Ground News. Ground News. My CEO turned me on to that. You can see an article or a topic and see a left-leaning article on it, a center-leaning article on it, and a right-leaning article on it just by swiping. Unbiased. Very cool. Anyway, why am I talking about all that? I'm talking about all this because, you know, this is Israel's using propaganda in the news too. Can we believe everything they're saying? No. But an overwhelming number of reports have come out, and I'll get into a little more detail of that. When it's all said and done, the number is going to get larger. There's, at the time of this recording, 1,300 dead Jews, 3,900 wounded. It's without precedent, and it has caused the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, to say they're at war, and this is what we've seen over the last few days. So who's Hamas? Well, Hamas is a terrorist organization funded by Iran, right? That's easy. That's not a secret. That's not, you know, everybody knows that. In fact, a PR person from Hamas stated that this was funded by Iran, and we're trying to establish that fact right now, even with the White House just saying, you know, this morning that they're trying to make that connection, but it's really, no pun intended, it's not rocket science. Iran, guys, has long since stated that their objective is to destroy Israel. And they literally say that. They are not hiding it. You could find it anywhere, okay? An Iranian leader celebrated the attacks, putting out his message, "We will stand by the Palestinian fighters until the liberation of Palestine and Jerusalem is completed." So their goal is to kill all the Jews. Where have I seen Esther? Iran has also signaled that they are developing a nuclear weapon that we know of. This has been currently in the news cycle for the last few years, right? In the past, they have threatened to, in their own verbiage, wipe Israel off the face of the map. Okay, so like let's just pretend Canada, right? America's hat. Canada, let's pretend that Canada, their motto, it's everywhere. They say it. They have shirt. You know, the president has said it. You know, all they're doing is saying that their goal is to wipe America off the face of the planet. We'd be like, you know, number one, whoa, Timmy Horton, like, easy there, Buckarooski. And we'd tighten on the border. And we'd be like, you know, could you guys be a little discreet about it? And then when something comes up, it's not going to be a surprise to us. Well, this is what's going on. Literally, although Iran isn't right next to Israel, all they want to do is kill them, and all their people are all around Israel all the time. One leader of Iran said, quote, "It is possible for us to witness a world without America and Zionism. But you had best know that this slogan for this goal are altogether attainable and surely can be achieved." Uh-oh. The regime that is occupying Jerusalem must be wiped from the map. Unquote. It always comes back to Jerusalem. Guys, the Bible predicted thousands of years ago that the end times events would revolve around Jerusalem. Not New York City, not Moscow, not Paris, not Los Angeles. Jerusalem, this tiny little city, this tiny sliver of land is going to play a key role in the events of the last days. It's a focal point for the end time events in the Bible, as well as where God is bringing the final kingdom in the book of Revelation back for good. Why? Zechariah 12:2-3 in the Old Testament says, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, and they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day, I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut into pieces, though all the people of the earth will be gathered together against it." Now, guys, the irony of all this is that the Biden administration, in giving $6 billion back to Iran, like, think about that. What a bad move it is to give money to a nation that sponsors, like, they live to sponsor terrorism. You know, it's so sad. Have you seen any of those pictures online ever that is like Iran 1962 or whatever, you know, 1968 or whenever, before they were overtaken by the regime? The women all looked like Americans in the 60s, and the guys, and they had fashionable clothes on and cool cars and like that. I went backwards. It's a bad move to give a nation that sponsors terrorism all around the world a ton of money. But here's where it gets interesting for students of Bible prophecy like me and like you, because the Bible says in the end times that Israel will be scattered and regathered. You want to talk about signs of the end times, the super sign and that the clock is ticking is that Israel's back in its homeland. I've covered that a lot. That's a big deal. And it happened on the heels of the Holocaust. Who would ever have thought, against all odds? Okay, you get it. So Ezekiel 38 and 37 talk about this regathering of Israel. That's episode 109 and 110 for me. And so I don't want to get into a lot of that, but the Bible's predicting all this thousands of years ago. And it's only recently that the Iranians and the Russians, like I said, have gotten into bed together. That's a big deal too. So people ask me about Russia. I don't want to go on a rabbit trail here. Okay. I want to actually take this to the supernatural side of things here in a second. What's going on with Israel? But, you know, as far as Russia is concerned, absolutely. According to the Bible, if you are still here on this earth and you see on the news that Russia is attacking Israel in a war, if you're here and you know nothing about it, no one's going to be around for a long time. That is the end of humanity as we know it. The beginning of the end. These are what I would call the birth pains. You're seeing Bible prophecy fulfilled before your very eyes, guys. Did Jesus say, when you see these things happen, freak out because you're dead in the water? No, he didn't say that. He said, when these things begin to come to pass in Luke 21:8, then look up. And lift up your eyes, for your redemption draweth nigh, in the King James. The thing to pray about is peace for Jerusalem. Yeah, but we want to pray that they arrive at, you know, if we want this thing to end and keep going now, Lord, give us peace in Jerusalem. it's interesting. How little most of us know about this conflict. So what I want to do is I want to take our remaining time and I want to talk about the supernatural component to all of this and some very surprising things we find in the Bible that we can look upon today and realize exactly why, who is doing what. We're just getting started, baby. Lucky you, right? Right. All right. So Israel has been attacked and obviously as a nation been almost completely eradicated many times over and just won't go away. At what point do you think it's an impossibility for them to go away? You know, even what Hitler does, from Haman in Esther to Hitler in World War II, you know, Hitler, when he knew the war was over, when he knew there was no hope and the Russian and the Allied forces were barreling down on him, that he continued until the very end to use more resources to kill Jews than he did to win the war. So what is Satan doing with this? He can't destroy Yahweh, obviously. But what happens if he gets to God's people? He missed it with Jesus. And we've talked about that a lot. But what could he do if he eradicated God's people? If he can destroy Israel, well, it negates the Bible. It negates the prophecy of the end times. It negates what Jesus did on the cross and where Jesus even came from. I mean, to go down that rabbit hole would take weeks. This is the play that he has. Now, there are other things going on with DNA manipulation. If he can keep people from being something other than human, right? But that's the whole transhuman thing. That's the end times side of things. That's a different war that we've talked much about. I want to stick to Israel here and what's going on with Israel. When it comes to who's stirring up what in the Middle East, there is one main factor from the Middle East. Now we have, again, proxy wars happening with Russia and China who are giving money, bolstering some of these Muslim nations with different weapons and funding them in different ways for right now. But as far as the Muslim nations around the vicinity of Israel, of course, Iran, modern-day Persia is the root of the problem. And there's a confrontation with Iran and Israel that won't be avoided. See, today in the news, you'll see that, you'll see Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf states are for the first time ever pondering what an alliance of sorts with Israel could look like. And this is freaking Iran out. Because it'd be the nail in the coffin for them. But it's starting to happen before their very eyes. It's happening now. For the country that they have vowed is their single mission to wipe off the face of the earth, coming into an agreement with the Saudis and others would mean Iran would never, ever have the chance to eradicate them, which is why it's so nerve-wracking right now. Iran knows there's some imminency, some urgency here. Remember in Esther, Haman came out of Persia, right? We know that Passover is the first in the Jewish calendar of the holidays, and we know what that represents, right? Deliverance and redemption at the beginning of Israel's history, coming out of Egypt, right? They had to take Passover first. It's a big deal. That's celebrating the birth of their nation. And remember we talked about Purim in the book of Esther, being reinstated. But Purim on the Jewish calendar is the last feast, and it represents what happens at the end of Israel's story. And I think the spirit of the old God that influenced Haman has returned and is influencing Iran once again. An attempt that is old and failed, but renewed today to use the Persians to wipe out the Jews. Now, Hamas is, you might be surprised, but it's actually a biblical word. So I think this is one that needs understanding by us. And it goes all the way back to Genesis 6. So when we talk about Hamas, like, I know it's a group that's here now, but, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, gang. In Arabic, Hamas is an acronym for Islam. Islam would call them freedom fighters. And I use those quotation, air quotations heavily on that, freedom fighters. But it also means something in Hebrew, and they're kind of sister languages, right? In Hebrew, it means violence. And the Bible talks about this. Now, listen to me. In the days of Noah, which we know, Genesis chapter 6, all flesh was corrupted by the Nephilim. God saw that all flesh corrupted. He was saddened that he even made man. And so he looks around, and what does he see? In Hebrew, the earth was filled with Hamas. Violence. Yahweh was so grieved that he made man that he flooded the entire earth. I don't think it's a real big jump to see here, in my opinion, that Hamas is connected to Noah. What does Jesus say in Matthew 24, 37 through 39? As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the last days. Well, what does that mean? Like, you know, you've always heard that, and I've heard preachers talk about that and people on podcasts and whatnot. And the Bible says, oh, people were marrying and getting drunk and, you know, were fighting with each other, blah, blah. And you kind of read that and you go, boy, that was probably the most vague and not helpful quotation Jesus has ever given us. You know, in that, boy, that could really mean anytime. And I know we can look at things now and say, oh, how violent they've gotten and how, you know, horrible the earth is. But there have been times in history, guys, where it has just been an absolute blood fest, okay? I think it's quite possible that we are dealing with this Hamas. It shall be Israel, God's chosen people, fighting this violence and what it stands for. Did you know a few weeks back when Hamas attacked Israel with their initial run in Aramaic, one of the words that they use, you know, like we use, like, you know, Operation Donkey Kong, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Well, they use one of theirs was the Arabic name for flood. I don't think that was on accident. Hamas moved in, violence moved in to Israel once again and beheaded babies. They killed Holocaust survivors. And they even sacrificed Jews by the fire of Moloch. Friends, these are all signs of ancient gods from the Old Testament who were controlling and influencing Israel's enemies in the conquest of Canaan and are once again today replaying their strategy before our very eyes. Guys, we are literally witnessing biblical prophecy. There's a guy in the Bible named Amalek. He was the progenitor of the Nephilim-infused tribe, the Amalekites. You'll see them all over the place. And they were basically a tribe mixed in with the Edomites. Where did the Edomites come from? Of course, Esau, right? The red, we've talked about this, Nephilim mix of foreign god worship that we see all throughout the Old Testament. And Amalek, shockingly, has a really special place in the Bible, as once those Israelites have their Passover and they do get out of Egypt and they cross that Red Sea at Baal-Zephon, right, where Jesus leads them past the God of the sea right into his face and the crossing of the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds, they come out of that. And guess who is the first freaking nation to attack the Israelites? Like, what an honor, huh? Amalek. Who did he attack? Well, in Exodus, here's what he did. Listen, the women, the children, and the stragglers. Guys, Amalek attacked the weak and the defenseless, those who could not defend themselves. Does this sound familiar? Do you see a spirit of Hamas here? So what does God say about Amalek? God says he will be at war, meaning God, Yahweh, I myself, he says, will be at war with Amalek in every generation. What? What? Who is a descendant of Amalek in the Bible? I'm not asking you because you won't know, but I'm going to tell you. You know who you know who a descendant of Amalek in the Bible is? Freaking Haman, the horrible from Esther. Yeah, he's an Amalekite, guys, who tried to use the Persian Empire to commit genocide and completely eradicate the Jewish people from the face of the earth. I believe what we are seeing now is the spirit of Amalek today that is playing out in the Middle East, both from Hamas and from Hezbollah. The same lowercase g God that aroused so many attempted extinction of the Jews is in full play today after thousands of years of carefully, I believe, preparing for this moment. How long can it last? And I don't want to be doom and gloom. I don't think the end times is doom and gloom. I can't wait for it. But for some of you who are like, oh, I love this life and I don't want to leave so badly. All right. Okay. How long do you think we have? Oh, Kyle, people have been saying Jesus is coming back for thousands of years. How long? Again, you need to go listen to episode 69 of mine. How long have we had Israel set up as a nation? And now all the cards on the table, all the players on the chessboard are currently here. Another 100 years? How long do you think Israel can hold out against that tension? Now, I'm glad we're there to have her back. If I can help you in some way, it would be this. Stop reading your Bible as Americans. I know some of you listen from overseas. Thank you. But I will tell you guys, us Americans, us red-blooded gringos, we read the Bible as if God himself wrote it for America, because that's what we do in America. When you read the Bible as Americans every day, you're forgetting who, what, and why it was even written for in the first place. Let's look into a little of this. Excuse me. In the Old Testament books of 1 Samuel, we have King Saul. You see, Israel demanded a king. Of course, they had judges before that. Well, first of all, they had Yahweh literally leading them. And then they complained. They didn't like what he was feeding them. They didn't like the way he was doing things. They didn't like all those laws from Leviticus and everything that God set up with his nation. So they slapped him in the face and God said, you know what? You deserve nothing from me, but I'll give you this line of judges. And one by one, these men and women would come and they would judge the Israelites until the Israelites cried and cried and cried about that. By the time Samuel came around and said, we don't want these guys judging us anymore. We want a king. Why do they want a king? Because everybody else had a king. What everybody else has, we want it. That sounds like us. So they demand of Samuel and God to give them a king. And at one point in 1 Samuel, it was just actually my reading today through the Bible. Ironically, this morning, King Saul at one point was commanded to go to a tribe and wipe out every man, woman, child, infant, ox, sheep, camel, and donkey from the Amalekite tribe. Yes, the Amalekites. And I know what you might be thinking. Kyle, that sounds as evil as what Hamas just did. Yeah, you have to understand something, friends. This is not a religious war that Yahweh is waging. This was a war against the seed of man versus the seed of Satan. And I mean literally is what's happening right now. We look at it in religious terms. We look at it as Americans. All flesh was corrupted, and the Nephilim were on the earth and after the flood, the Bible says. So they were here after the flood. We have discussed this ad nauseum all over the promised land of the Jews when they did, in fact, get that Passover, have that exile, get attacked by the Amalekites. All these Nephilim tribes had gone and, for some reason, settled all over the promised land, the place where Israel was going. These Nephilim tribes camped there. They made war there in Gaza. They infested the DNA pool there, knowing that the Israelites would one day be there and they would not have rest until every single Israelite was wiped off the planet. And we still see this happening today. When I think of Israel constantly wanting to be like every other nation, I always remember that's just exactly what they got. And in so comes a lot of bad mistakes. At one point, Saul, he's about at his end. He has been screwing up left and right. And he was told to eradicate the Amalekites. And guess what he did? He killed a lot of them, but he spared the king. You know what the king's name was? This might ring a bell from today's episode so far. Agag. He spared this king, which was exactly what God told him not to do. So what does Samuel do? We see Samuel steps in personally, walks up, and Agag's thinking to himself, Agag the Amalekite, I might say. He walks up to, Samuel walks up to him, and Agag's thinking, all right, I survived. Everything got me here. Everything's cool. He kind of forgot about the war. And Samuel says, hey, Saul, can I have that sword? And he takes the sword from Saul, and he goes, and he hacks Agag into pieces. To accomplish what the seed of man needed to survive. Genesis 3, guys, it's all tied together. Why did Saul do this? Why did he sympathetically and wrongfully allow a Nephilim leader to remain alive? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think anybody does, but I've always been a little suspicious of Saul for a few things. For one, he was taller than any of the other Israelites, the Bible says. He's a tall guy. Not that he was Nephilim, because the Bible says Saul, when he was going to die, he went to heaven. But he sure was, I think, welcoming from some of these evil spirits into his life, as we see him repeatedly trying to kill David. That's the whole reason he had David there. But don't get me started on harps and music and vibrations and tones that could make these evil ones go away. Who cares about all this, Kyle? I do, because Saul spared Amalekite's life and tried to spare Agag, whose lineage made it possible one day for Haman, the freaking Agagite, to appear in Esther and almost wipe out the Jews. It all works together. We have to remember Israel's war against these ancient nations. It's not a physical battle. I mean, it is. There's components to that. And while we all know Paul says we battle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, these governing lowercase g gods, hell-bent on destroying Israel. But we take that verse. This war is against
principles and principalities and principletarians, and we take it and we look and we go, we got to wake up each day. We got to put on our belt of righteousness and our socks of purity and our underwear of holiness, because some demons might be attacking me while I'm in the line for a coffee at Starbucks. Hey. Guys, this is what Yahweh/ancient fallen angel wars are happening before our very eyes. And I know that because in the book of Daniel, we talked about this. Gabriel took a little longer than expected to get to Daniel to tell him some really important things about the exact time we're living in right now. But he took a while getting there because this dude named the Prince of Persia attacked him. Yeah. During flight, right? When Gabriel was trying to get there. Now, Gabriel didn't teleport and he didn't have wings. He traveled in some sort of craft of ancient technology. Well, even better technology than we have today. He had a war with some other extraterrestrials for like 21 days. It was so intense with this Prince of Persia that Michael the freaking archangel had to come and intervene. Man, I wonder what his ship looked like. Oh, and the Prince of Greece was there too. Yeah, it's all in the Bible. These princes didn't die. They're immortal. They're still around. Yahweh's going to crush their heads one day, but they're on the news cycle every day when we turn on the TV, but we don't see them because we're not looking for them. We're too wrapped up in our sports betting and our HGTV. If you're looking for these ancient gods on the news, you're going to see them. Because the Prince of Persia, guys, still has his mighty kingdom after thousands of years, and he is embedded in Iran today and fuels its insatiable desire to destroy God's people. This is a war of the gods, friends. This is not a Marvel movie or the Immortals or the Eternals. This is what these scripts of these movies are based on. It's a war between good and evil, flesh and blood, extraterrestrial versus human. It's a war for DNA. It's a war nearly won by the enemy, if not for Noah and his faithfulness. The Tower of Babel, the Nephilim attempt failed, and war soon began against Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael has something to do with Muslims today, but then war again broke out between Jacob and Esau. Jacob obeyed the Lord, at least when it was really important for him to do. And Esau rejected the Lord. The two brothers split and started nations. Jacob, of course, would be renamed by Yahweh to Israel. And Esau's plagued lineage would turn into the Edomites and so many current nations that oppose Israel to this very day. If you recall from the account, Rebekah, their mom, felt these brothers wrestling in her womb. Wasn't indigestion, gang? Fighting in the womb, Genesis 25:22 says. That when she asked God what on earth was happening inside of her, he answered her. This is great. Man, I love the Bible. I know. Why would you keep reading our Bibles like Americans is beyond me. God answers her and says, oh yeah, hey, about that. Not indigestion. It's literally two nations that are warring inside you, warring right now as babies. Oh, and the older son inside you will serve the younger son. Once they erupt out of your vaginal canal in a WWE cage match for the ages. That's funny, Kyle. Yeah, well, Esau came out first, and guess what? Jacob was right behind him. The Bible says, doing what? Grabbing at his heel. Jacob would make this his MO, as he later grabbed his brother's birthright and cheat him out of blessings and many other things. Meanwhile, Esau is a whole different story. He comes out of the Rebekah's lady chute, and immediately everyone gasps in horror as to what they saw. Man, look, we laugh. Like my kids are all, I think, we're so blessed. They're just such good-looking kids. And thanks to Rachel, right? And my boys, good-looking young boys. But, you know, Kaysen, buddy, when he came out and he came out and I looked at him for the first couple of days and I thought to myself, my God, sweet Jesus in heaven, this is the ugliest child that you have bequeathed upon me out of the loins of my wife. I mean, you know, maybe some of the Conehead was going on, but he's just not a good looking baby. And I thought I had a situation on my hands, but there's something completely different here. Esau comes out, and the Bible says he was like a man baby with a thick red North Face coat on, but it covered his entire body. I'm not going to get into it right now, because I have before, but boy, is there a rabbit trail for me to go on with that. He had something going on, gang. Epigenetically, something going on. So, out of this, Israel and Iran eventually are ultimately born. Now, hang on a second. There's a lot of cool gods mentioned in the Bible, but Kos is never one of them. I know. There's a lot of cool ones. Not Kos. That's Q-O-S. Kos is actually the god of the Edomites, according to history. So why isn't this Kos entity mentioned in the Bible? Well, I'd say I think he is. And I think he's been here all along. And I think he's been orchestrating what I'm seeing on the news as early as this morning. It all began in ancient Egypt. Kyle, I knew it. I know. Freaking Egypt. 8th century BC temple inscriptions we found dating back to the Bronze Age show something interesting. Do they mention the Kos god, Kyle? You bet they do. As I dug deeper on this, something fascinating came to light, I think. The ancient meaning for Kos, this god, Q-O-S, was protects and shepherds and is my friend. Now, names are important back then, but we always see that Satan's always ripping off God, kind of just taking the reversal of it and perverting it in that way. It's a derived parallel stolen from their word for Yahweh, which meant friend of the Israelites. It's just a direct reversal. The God of the Edomites, even today, Yahweh has the only original ideas. Now, I don't want to get into the nerdery here, but there are paper trails for Kos, this god in the Old Testament, and names derived from the root word all attributed to Edomite tribes every single time in the Bible. So when we see the Hebrew servants of Yahweh in the Bible, we see parallel names for servants of Kos. So it's there. I don't want to get into the specifics of all that. There was a translation in Psalms where we see Kos alluded to anyway. Anyway, this entity is a perfect candidate, I think, for the Prince of Persia, a very strong adversary and one of the original adversaries of Yahweh, one with ancient and fierce bad blood. And it's my belief, through my studies, that there was a cosmic war, possibly, for the ultimate enemy of Yahweh at some point in the Old Testament. Now, sure, Satan's always been there. He's been a lead candidate, but so was Baal and Moloch and Apollyon and so on and so on. But none, though, as mysterious and as powerful as Kos, until he was somehow written out of the story, relegated to Persian keeper, possibly, I think, by a power struggle won by the entity we call Satan. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter as far as this study goes. It's outside of the scope of that. The important thing is to understand that we're seeing on the news today is nothing new. There's an ancient war being rekindled in these, the last days. You know, Jesus, Paul, and others prophesy over and over again that in the end times, biblically, listen to this, a great deception will fall upon people, onto both Christians and non-believers. Now, myself, growing up in the church, being in the ministry for so long, you know, it's been said over and over and over again that this coming deception was maybe that we were going to see somebody come on the scene that's going to claim to be the Messiah, claim to be Jesus. But I disagree with that. Like, I just don't see that fooling anyone or doing anything to anyone. Now, the Antichrist is certainly going to, you know, be the antithesis of Jesus and turn, especially at the desecration of the temple at the 3.5 year mark of the tribulation, right? So we know that's going to come. But I don't think it's this, I don't think this dude coming as Jesus with long hair and kind of like hippie dude that's like, you know what, just follow me. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's people asleep at the eschatological wheel of the bus and in their misunderstanding of who Israel is. And why do I say this? Well, I don't know. I'm going to make this number up, but this is just my opinion. 99% of churches today don't talk about biblical prophecy. Not in any kind of sense that's constructive, and not really not when it comes to end times, eschatology, biblical prophecy. I've said this before. It just doesn't bring in the masses. And I get it. I understand. It also might not keep the lights on and the big budgets paid for, because people need to hear about being kind to their neighbors, and that's great, and about getting through grief, and that's great, and about inviting more people to church, and that's great, and that's why we have small groups, and that's great, about and cleaning up the junk drawers of their hearts. We have a junk drawer on stage. That's great. But we better avoid abortion or sexual sins or end time whores or fallen angels or demons or the supernatural, because wars like that, man, they don't pay the bills. And so here we are, a country under deception, sleepwalking through our devotions, reading current events into the Bible, all the while, I think, whoring after titles and money and status and likes and influence while we get absorbed into the greatest deception in human history. Churches sleeping, nations sleeping, Christians sleeping, dreaming of self-gratification while a nightmare literally unfolds in front of us. Now, it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but the final curtain is falling, my friends. The veil is thinning. The land of Israel is a modern miracle. Go back and listen to episode 69. Nice. You know, Gaza's mentioned in the Bible a lot. Yeah, I didn't know if you knew that, but almost all of them are bad. I know. They're almost all about how wicked Gaza is, and most importantly, how wicked their leaders are, and how their people have been led astray. And there's nothing new, and this is not an indictment on the innocent Palestinians who are caught under this evil regime in any of these Muslim countries, but many prophets in the Old Testament were sent and were written about to proclaim Yahweh's impending judgment on Gaza's leadership and those who partner with them. This is a big deal. Genesis 10, God talks about Gaza and the land of the enemy of Israel, the Canaanites. And later in the Old Testament, Gaza becomes the base camp for another evil enemy of the Israelites. Yeah, you guessed it, the Philistines. Judges chapter 1, God commands Judah to take Gaza because it rightfully belonged to the Jewish people, and so they did. God uses a mostly bad, and I mean bad man in Samson, to go into Gaza and to destroy its leaders, even though it would cost him his life. I want to wind down with a few things. In Jeremiah 47, one of the pharaohs conquered Gaza and started a really volatile and long-standing tension between Egypt and Gaza that we see today even raging against the southern border of Egypt and Gaza. This is all in the Bible. So I'm not looking at anything on the news going, oh, wow, I didn't know that. I mean, yeah, some current events, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen as far as when Israel starts going in on a ground invasion here, and what kind of wars Iran going to bring into Syria with the Hezbollah from the north, who's going to get pulled into this whole thing. We don't know all that yet. You see how the bigger picture is coming together for you. There was a prophet in the Old Testament named Amos, and he was told by God to write about the wickedness of Gaza. And listen, the divine judgment from Yahweh that was coming. Zephaniah and Zechariah in the Old Testament were told by God to warn of judgment coming one day to Gaza and its nearby Philistine leaders and lowercase gods. Jeez, Kyle. Does every Bible verse about Gaza say something horrific about them? I'm glad you asked, because Acts 8, where I want to end, of all that Gaza is, of all that Hamas is that you've learned, of all that Iran is against Israel, and of all the wrong they've done over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, even by the New Testament. Listen to what Yahweh was providing. Acts chapter 8 tells us the apostles and the Christians were busy running around teaching and preaching the gospel after Jesus had ascended to many in Samaria, which is the West Bank, over by Jordan and Jerusalem. But an angel of the Lord came to Philip and said, look, I know you guys are partying over here on the West Bank, but I want you to get up and go to Gaza, right? And Philip goes, and what happens? He finds a man, an Ethiopian eunuch of all things, reading a scroll written by the prophet Isaiah. This guy was literally reading Old Testament prophecies of Jesus right there in Gaza. Guys, and I want you to see what shines through, because Yahweh knew exactly where Philip was. Yahweh knew exactly what gods were still in that land. And he helps this man come into a relationship with Jesus and get baptized. You know the story. I've always found it fascinating that Philip was, it seems he was transported supernaturally out of there very quickly. And I think it has something to do with where he was and how dangerous it was to be there. But I see that the gospel itself can even be a light that is taken into the darkness of Gaza and its leaders and Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran and Syria. It is no match for God's power. There is an important truth here, friends. Yes, many of the leaders in Gaza, they hate Yahweh and they hate Israel. But what does God do? He still offers love, salvation, and repentance to all who seek it, whether Palestinian, Muslim, Sunni, Shia, Hamas, or Hezbollah, or you as you listen to this right now. A war is coming. Maybe you hear this in the middle of that war. Somehow, digitally, you find this, and you think, everything this man has said has happened. It is not me. It is in the Bible. And I will tell you to brace yourself for what's coming and prepare your heart only to have room for Jesus Christ and his saving grace. Listen to nothing any other religion, organization, or powerful men have to say. This is an ancient war, one that is being waged now more than ever in the same ways it was waged in the beginning. So in the beginning, so it shall be in the end. So in the days of Noah, so it shall be today. Thank you for listening.